I've had some bad sports days. I cheer for Toronto teams. I watched my football team lose a Super Bowl on the 1 yard line because they wouldn't hand it to one of the greatest goal line backs of all time. This one I could put up against just about anything. It was awful. I can't remember ever turning off a finals game in any sport before it was finished, but I could not watch the Thunder celebrate. I did not see the podiums. I saw some clips of their players trying to pop champagne bottles and struggling, and that many of them had never had a drink before. So congrats to the Thunder. In my opinion, the most deplorable franchise in all of professional sports. But who cares? Who cares? It sucked. I hated it. I got a lot of nice messages from people that were sending me like, hey, go Pacers, go Pacers, go Pacers. I know what this is like for, I think like what Nordiques fans could probably empathize with this, where they lose the team and then they go to Colorado and immediately it's a mini dynasty. But yeah, this one's a different kind of gross sports pain, especially considering I know a lot of listeners of this program do not care whatsoever about the Seattle Supersonics, but just in general gives me an icky feel. I don't like in at all when teams move for conspicuous reasons. But at least usually when you can see it where it's a tiny market that's not able to support the team, like when the Atlanta Thrashers move, I don't go, oh, yeah, I really feel for their fan base. But when a team gets hijacked the way that Seattle's did, and if anybody ever does actually care, there's an excellent free documentary that's available on YouTube, a Webby-winning documentary called Sonicsgate. Highly recommend to kind of illustrate the differences between, yeah, a franchise that doesn't support their team and then losing them and then what happened here. Anyways, huge legacy moment, obviously, for Canadian Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. That's the story in this country, but also in the NBA. He's 26. He just won an MVP in a season where Nikola Jokic exists and followed that up with a championship and beat Nikola Jokic in order to get there. And yeah, the Nuggets were compromised, and yeah, Tyrese Haliburton got hurt in the game 7, which was, yeah, just a really awful moment. I think even the biggest diehard Thunder fan would have looked at that and said, oh no, a guy gutting it out through an injury in a championship game in a game 7, and to have that just instant reaction of he knew exactly what it was and the rehab that's going to take. It's going to be the most memorable moment from that final, obviously. And you wish him a strong recovery. You hate seeing that for a player, but I do think Halliburton's stock in terms of the way we're going to perceive him moving forward has greatly changed for the positive. He went from someone that the league was talking about being overrated and the holes in him and this whole stupid superstar debate and whether he is one to being what I would imagine is one of the players that is going to be the easiest for this league to market moving forward. And that was a huge part of this championship. And what I'm really curious about moving forward and kind of bringing it back to Shai is the league clearly is dying for new guys to market. Jokic doesn't resonate the way that you wish a player of his ilk would. Doncic, I believe, will, especially now that he's a Laker. And yeah, markets matter less than they used to, but if you play for the Lakers and you're a superstar talent and you're still paired with LeBron, it's going to mean more. The game is going to be centered largely around you from a narrative standpoint. But the Boston Celtics won, and Jason Tatum, same thing, doesn't really move people that way. There haven't been guys that feel like they're so obviously going to fill the shoes of the generation before them. The LeBron James, the Kevin Durants, the Steph Currys, the players that we've grown so familiar with over the last couple of decades. And I really am optimistic about Shai being one of the guys that can fill that. Because if you're talking about the path to greatness, that's the thing we care about in sports. Can you be a great, especially in this league, and to be 26 years old and to win an MVP, to play a different, I think, offensive style than a lot of his contemporaries, with his ability in the mid-range and even just the stuff that's around him, and I know that not all of it is great, the discussion about the foul baiting and the flopping, but either way, the fact that he's going to be polarizing will generate more conversation. But to follow that up with a championship right away and be on this team that looks like they've got an incredible pathway to multiple championships in an era where, what, that was the seventh different champion in a row? The parity era, right? This is what I was talking about with my appreciation of the Oilers, Panthers too, and the Panthers that they've gone back three straight times, is I think these things are going to be harder and harder and harder to accomplish in professional sports. Football, it should remain to a degree because quarterbacks are so unbelievably important. But you saw it in this series with basketball, which is we've gone away from a big three era because the league is so deep that the only way that you can really compete is if you have 8-9 guys. And both these teams had that. But Shea is now looking at something that can genuinely put him into the conversation of among the greatest point guards of all time. Because to get your first championship and an MVP at 26 years old, to have a runner-up for the MVP the year before, and to be looking at your team and saying, okay, next year, everybody's under contract. You're adding a first-round pick from last year that was stashed away in Europe in Nikolai Topic. You've got, I think they have number 15, number 24, and 44 in the draft this week. Their salaries don't look completely unreasonable in terms of what they're going to have to be able to get done moving forward. Chet is still so young. He's like 23 years old, 22 years old. I really do think that in the non-dynasty era, the Thunder have an opportunity to build one centered around who is now the greatest Canadian basketball player to ever live. And I'm a huge Steve Nash guy. I think that it's going to be a thing like the Raptors, where you go, well, Vince Carter's not the greatest Raptor of all time, but he's the most influential. I think it's going to be really hard for Shea to ever pass Steve Nash in terms of Canadian influence, simply because he was the first. He won two MVPs as the first. But Shea, no doubt about it, is the greatest Canadian-born basketball player who's ever lived, and now really does have the potential to be one of the most important players when it comes to marketing this game and building championships. And if you were trying to buy stock in legacy right now, like who is going to have the greatest legacy, it's flat out between him and Wembanyama, who are in the league right now. That's it. That's the list. Upcoming players, who are you buying stock in, is going to be able at the end of their career say, hey, which one of these guys was the greatest? And I'm removing Jokic just because he's a few years older. And I don't know if Doncic, yeah, maybe. But right now, those are my 1-2. Wemby and the Canadian, Shea Gilgeous-Alexander. The last legacy piece I want to discuss quickly before I get to James Myrtle here is just like Sam Presti has been long revered as one of the best general managers in all of sports. He's definitely got the belt right now, especially now after winning a championship. But the one knock that he had on the resume was that, hey, he's never gotten it done. Hey, it's rebuild. Hey, they cheaped out on the James Harden thing. They made this huge mistake. They blew it with the first Thunder Corps. And then he recovered from that immediately, losing Kevin Durant, James Harden, having Russell Westbrook and Paul George, and then flipping that into, again, not only the NBA champions, but a team that looks more sustainable and better built for the future than literally any team in the sport outside of maybe the San Antonio Spurs. It's incredible. It's unbelievable the job that he's done. And so now when you're looking at teams where they're saying, hey, we're going to take the step back to take a step forward, I think we were really down on tanking, especially with this past season and the teams that ended up winning the lottery and the Sixers experience. And you can point to the Charlotte Hornets and all these other horrible franchises. But because of the Thunder success, you're always going to be able to point to, hey, this team did it the right way. This team accumulated the right pieces. This team drafted well. They kicked bad contracts down the road. They made the appropriate trades at the appropriate time, despite being, well, especially being a small market where you go, well, was it riskier to move off of a Paul George when how many free agents were going to sign there? So I think now Sam Presti, same as Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, when you're talking about legacies, he is the guy that you're looking at and saying, you can go down as one of the greatest general managers in all of sports, especially in the context of this era. Anyway, we'll see if the same is going to apply to Brad Treliving, because at this point, it's really starting to feel like if he pulls off an incredible offseason, it would be a little surprising to some people. James Myrtle of The Athletic joins me now. What's up, buddy? How are we doing?
Good, good.
Yeah, you sound a little out of breath there. Like that kept
I'm not going to go run in this. I'll tell you that.
No, that's disgusting outside. Yeah, it's we waited all like for a month. Going, why isn't the weather here? Why isn't the weather here? And then all of a sudden, boom, it just comes in terms of like 45 degrees. Okay, so let's start with this. There's contracts that are being signed. Matt Duchene got done. Obviously, Brock Nelson got done. You saw Maverick Bourque. Like, there's these deals that are trickling in with guys re-upping with their franchises. Sam Bennett is drunkenly taken to bar stages saying that he's not leaving. And yeah, what you're seeing around the league right now is some, I would say, for the most part, outside of probably Brock Nelson's deal, some team-friendly deals getting done in pretty quick order. When we left the off, or what do we call it? the exit media interviews, one of the takeaways for me was John Tavares saying that he had already had productive conversations with Brad Treliving. Treliving went up. He talked about changing the DNA. There's some stuff floating out there about Tavares, how far apart they are. But I really did think that this was going to be one of the easier deals to get done. I genuinely expected Tavares and the Leafs to be kind of easy peasy. What is the latest that you're hearing with Tavares and where these two sides are?
I think it's been harder for the Leafs than they expected to. And, you know, I still think it's going to get done, but there's some, I guess it depends how you want to frame it. To me, there's like some good agenting being done where they're trying to push the limits of how high the Leafs are willing to go. And when they see where that is, then I think it'll get done. But they're not there yet. So, you know, I think the Brock Nelson number is problematic for the Leafs because it shows the value that he has. And the other thing that's problematic too is that, as you said, you see teams locking all of the centers up around the league. Like there's, you have to put Ryan Donato in there too with Chicago, and it's going to be like John Tavares, and then the next center is going to be who? Like Ilya Suter or something like that. So I think that Tavares can get $8 million on the open market if he goes there. Mm-hmm. The question is that a realistic possibility? Like, you know, if they can't get something done with the Leafs, is he willing to do that? And like I said, I still think they get something done, but it's been harder than the Leafs were expecting. And I think there's a little bit of frustration there on both sides. And we'll see if they grind it out and get something done before July 1.
So I guess I'm at a little bit of a loss with this one. And why I expected it to be easier is that I thought Tavares got it. I really did think that he understood, yeah, of course I can make this money on the open market. I'm John Tavares. I'm coming off of another quality season from a goal-scoring standpoint. But when you lose to the Florida Panthers and we're having all this conversation about, hey, how these teams are building sustainable winners, and especially after Toronto has had so many difficult exits and the fact that he's been surrounded by a few older players that, granted, were at obviously different stages of their career, but you think about the deal Mark Giordano took, right? When he signed here, it was for nothing. He had a clear higher market. Yeah, he
wasn't 34 though, right? Like he was older.
34. He wasn't 34, but he left at least $2 million a season off the table when he decided to stay with the Toronto Maple Leafs. And yeah, you're right. Like Spezza, same thing. Like when he was, what did he say? What was his famous quote was, if I could have taken less, I would have done it. John Tavares made $77 million with the Toronto Maple Leafs. Like, he is a extremely wealthy hockey player. And at this point, this is about legacy. I thought more than it was about money, which is legacy, not just to win and what it would mean for him to have a Stanley Cup on his resume, but also to do it with the Toronto Maple Leafs and to be loved by this fan base and the city that he obviously is going to spend the rest of his life living in. I think that the Leafs are taking the right approach here in terms of trying to squeeze him and saying, yeah, we're trying to change the DNA. We're not just doing that with the roster composition. We're doing that with the way that we approach negotiations and capitulating to John Tavares and paying him anywhere near what his actual market is. I actually think is unacceptable for this team, even in a year where, like, I'm with you that you can't punt. You can't just go, oh, well, we're taking a step back. We're focusing on the following year when there's more free agents. That's lunacy to me. But I also understand their position of saying, hey, man, we're doing the same thing that Brisson did it with Tampa Bay. Like, you want to play this out? We're going to do the Stamkos deal. And if you want to leave, enjoy Utah, AKA Nashville, and get your money and have it be that way.
Yeah, I think the debate is, I think that, you know, if Tavares stays, there's going to be a hometown discount. And the debate is how much is enough and how much, you know, where's the middle ground between the two sides. And Tavares' idea of what a hometown discount is could be a lot different than what the Leafs are thinking it is. And, you know, if he can get, let's put it this way, if Tavares could get $30 million plus on the open market, how much should he get from the Leafs? And what does that look like? And how do you structure that deal? And, you know, I thought something, probably maybe not the exact same numbers, but something like the Tanev deal would have made sense, where you stretch it out over more years. And then, you know, that's what I thought was going to happen. So I'm a bit surprised that, I think that that's probably where they end up, but we'll see. It's been, like I said, it's been harder than they expected, and that could just be good agenting and just getting that number up a little bit more. And I think when it's all said and done, the Leafs are going to get a discount, but maybe it's not as much of a discount as they were hoping for. And to play devil's advocate with what you're saying, if they let him go, if he does decide to go somewhere else, I don't know what the Leafs are going to do at center. Because you talk to people around the league and they're saying it's basically impossible to find a center. There's nothing in free agency. There's almost nothing in trade. And the Leafs could end up, if Tavares walks, they could end up, you know, with, I don't know, Nylander as a second line center, or Domi, or, you know, having to use someone internally because they just can't find anyone else.
So I said Brisson, I meant Brisbois, but, I'm fine with letting him walk. I know that's probably not a widely shared opinion, or maybe the consensus opinion is, hey, if you can still get a discount, why wouldn't you just take the discount? Tavares is what, 35 years old next season? The idea that he's going to play out this deal as a second line center, which is what he's still looking at dollar wise, is nuts. You could see that change drastically just even into next season. And I don't think it will. I think that he's still going to have a productive career. But no, I like the stance that Tampa took with Steven Stamkos. Hey, if you want to be here and you want to continue to build your legacy in this market, then it has to be at an extremely team-friendly deal. That's part of what's the future with this franchise. If you want to go and win a negotiation and talk about your market value and do good agenting, cool. We're over that as an organization. We're done trying to pay close to market value or feeling like tiny haircuts for players that haven't accomplished anything are going to be the modus operandi here. And with Tavares, and my biggest pushback for the Leafs and the easiest position that they can take is looking at it and going, okay, there's no other center market, but if you do lose Tavares, what are you losing in terms of what you've had with team success? Like, what has John Tavares ultimately given you that you feel like you just absolutely cannot part with? So, yeah, year one, maybe he's the second line center, even though most people have agreed, like, even that formula, you're not too sure of. So year two, he's a second line center, and then maybe year three, he's on the wing, and you're going to pay, what, $6+ million for that? Absolutely no way. I think if you're the Leafs, you have to be pointing to that Duchesne contract and going, yeah, this is the deal. You get 4.5, except for we'll stretch it out over longer term. So we'll get you to like 20+ million bucks, you know, maybe 4.5 over 5, something like that, where you say this is taking you to the end of your career, but you've always got a place with the Maple Leafs. And the other part too is, like, I just don't understand how he can't recognize the value in terms of what he would get back from the fan base signing a deal like that, versus what it's going to look like if he does sign for $6 million to be here for 3 years.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's going to be really interesting. It'll be really interesting. I think it's probably what's going to end up happening is he's going to have a tough decision, and he's going to have to leave some money on the table and decide what he wants to do. And I think that you're right. I think the Leafs are taking the right approach, where they're being pretty aggressive with this one. But on the flip side, I can see I don't know what they're going to do without him. You know, so it's really interesting. And I think you set the line at the right place too. You know, I think 4.5 over 5 years is fair. you know, it's still going to be close to, I mean, what's that work out to, like $23 million. Mm-hmm. He's definitely leaving some money on the table, but it's a reasonably fair offer in this climate. It's not the Brock Nelson deal, but to get that, like you said, you're going to have to go to Utah or somewhere else.
Again, you add that. So let's say it's 4.5 over five. That's $22.5 million. You're almost sitting at $100 million career earnings from the Toronto Maple Leafs to finish your career. Like, it boggles the mind how that wouldn't be enough when it's talking about, hey, this is the place that you wanted to be. And that's the muscle that I think is really important for the Leafs to flex. And I know there are a lot of naysayers that are going, nobody wants to play in Toronto, blah, blah. I think that there are a lot of players that would prefer not to be here. I acknowledge that. I think that this is a league where a lot of its players shy away from the big markets, that there's drawbacks to playing in a Canadian city from a family standpoint that some guys don't want to endure. They find the media stuff to be exhausting. They'd rather be in a warm climate like Florida and just wear flip-flops to the arena and hang out after, not pay the state taxes, whatever it is. Tavares, as a guy who is from here, lives here, has set up his family here, seems to absolutely care about the idea of having a legacy as a Toronto Maple Leaf. The stake is pretty obvious from the Leaf standpoint. It's, hey, take it or leave it. Everyone said the same thing with Stamkos, where they were going, can you believe the disrespect that the Tampa Bay Lightning are showing their captain in offering him this contract at $4.5 million? But I actually think that should be the bar, is if you are of this age, 36 years old, 37 years old, and you are liking your chances of staying with an organization that's trying to compete, they cannot be paying you market dollars, even with a rising cap, moving into the later years of your career. And yeah, I don't care about Dallas's state free tax or the fact that Duchesne is making buyout money. The fact that he was willing to stay with Dallas at that contract number tells me that John Tavares has to do the same thing. Otherwise, I don't think that people are going to be shedding tears about him leaving. And you as an organization have to change that model of, we're living in fear that players leave because we don't know how to replace them. It's got to be, these are our terms. If you don't want to accept them, we will figure something else out. Okay, Nyes is a little trickier because, again, another deal where there were signs of optimism at the exit meetings. So maybe I should stop caring about what guys say at the exit press conferences. But Nyes seemed like a guy who also got it, who also seemed to understand, like, I want to be a Toronto Maple Leaf. I don't want this to be hard. I don't want to go to free agency and have this offer sheet stuff looming. I want to be a Toronto Maple Leaf. Which of these sides is looking for more? Where do you think that this lands as of today? And does this get done before July 1st?
No, I don't. I'd be really surprised to see it get done before July 1st. I've been talking to a lot of agents around the league over the last few days, and what's happening, and this applies to the Tavares thing too, is agents are seeing leverage here. They're seeing not a lot of players are going to make it to free agency. Teams are locking up their pending UFAs. There's tons of teams with money. You know, you look at the cap space around the league, there's a whole bunch of teams with $20, $25, $30 million to spend, and there's going to be nothing to spend it on. So they feel like there's leverage. And that even applies to the Nyes situation, because I don't know if it's going to happen or not, but the offer sheet possibility feels a lot more real this year than other years, just because you're going to have a bunch of teams that want to get better, that are going to have cap space, that are going to have draft picks, and they're going to be sitting there on July 2nd or July 3rd, not able to get what they wanted to get done without a chair in the game of musical chairs, and thinking about, we got to do something bold here. And who's the RFA name at the top of the list that they could go throw picks and a big money offer at? So that's the leverage that camp has, and it sounds like they're going to use it.
Again, I know that they're wildly different in terms of value, like Maverick Bourque and Matthew Nyes. But to use Dallas as yet another example, they get him done on a one-year contract worth what, like $900,000? I think it was under $1 million. And it just gets done. And it just becomes such a point of frustration, I think, for everybody in this market. And I hope that the front office realizes it, that these deals, like you mentioned the agents and feeling like there's this leverage standpoint and that they can go to free agency and get extra dollars and all this. Yeah, for sure. And then you look around the league and see all of these players re-signing. And some of them, like, I didn't love the Frederick deal, for example, right? I went 8 years. Didn't he just play 11 minutes a game in the playoffs? That seems like a pretty heavy ticket for a guy that, yeah, I think is a good player, but if you told me that they were moving off of him and going a different direction, I wouldn't be like, holy crap, this is a huge risk to be taking. To see around hockey that the agents seem to be squeezing the Maple Leafs more than most of the other franchises that we're seeing get business done, why do you think this is? Is this, again, like I hate saying media climate, but it is a part of it where you go, okay, these guys are just more famous. They're bigger names. They're just like, they're in more conversations. Like, why is this happening in Toronto again under different management when around the league, even though those agents are telling you the things that they are, we're not seeing that in actual application?
I think that the two players we're talking about have huge value in the league. I mean, they produce, you know, there's what other players are available that were 30 plus goal scorers last year? There's
sure,
almost
but Duchesne
nothing
finished
there.
With 82 points. Like, you know, he didn't have as many goals as Tavares did last season. And I don't think he's as good of a player, but if we're talking about, hey, who was so reluctant or who wanted to go to free agency, it's like, yeah, like he would have been one of the top guys that you would have mentioned. And what does he do? He resigns immediately.
I mean, it's kind of like a personal choice for him, right? Like he's done that before and it didn't work out in Nashville and he got bought out and his family's happy there and he's playing a key role on a good team. And he did take a big haircut for sure. But that doesn't mean that everyone's going to do it, right?
For sure.
So
not everyone, but a lot are.
Rantanen took less for Dallas too. I mean, the talk was that Rantanen wanted to go to when he had to give the list to Carolina, where do you want to go? The talk was it was Dallas and Toronto, but the number in Toronto was a lot different than it was in Dallas. So that tells you something there.
Yeah, to me, the most important part of what they're going to do with their culture this offseason is genuinely not what's going to happen with the roster makeup. Like I would love it if they signed Brad Marchand, right? And I'm willing to overpay for a free agent that you're bringing in here that has that kind of pedigree. I believe in the intangibles. I believe in the imprint that he could have on the younger players. But again, Brad Marchand is a guy who's coming off of another Stanley Cup win, who's owned your organization and who you're buying off of the market. You're saying, okay, yeah, what's the difference between him and Tavares? A lot. Tavares is a part of your culture. He's a part of your team. He's a guy that wore the captaincy for your organization and who is, born and raised here, that you're trying to say, hey, don't you want to stay? Don't you want to be a part of the solution versus trying to go out and attract a player like Marchand, who's, again, also earned it over the course of his career and took sweetheart deals his entire life. So you kind of understand why he would want to get paid more than a guy like Tavares, who, again, made $77 million from the Toronto Maple Leafs. But the most important thing is going to not be, hey, who do you bring in? Like, yeah, obviously we'll be on the ice, but from a long-term standpoint and for the health of this organization, I think it's going to be trying to get those cap numbers in order and saying, yeah, we're not just pushovers and we're not just afraid of letting players walk. We're not afraid of putting players in a position that gets a little bit uncomfortable. And I think that applies to the RFAs as well.
Yeah, but I mean, look what happened with Edmonton, right? Like they played hardball with their two guys and they lost them both. So that's the game of chicken with the Nyes one is, what do you think the realistic possibility is of an offer sheet? And when I was down at the combine, all the agents were saying there's going to be lots of offer sheets and all the teams were saying there's not going to be any offer sheets. And it's just a question of who you believe. And I think there's going to be teams desperate enough to do it. So is the offer sheet on Nyes going to be something where you end up regretting not getting it done before July 1 and not meeting their asking price?
So that brings me to the next thing, which is, I'll just get this one out of the way. So they're not going to take the meeting with Marner, right?
I don't think so. It's over. I mean, I think it's been over for a while and it's just coming out now how over it is. So I think people should everyone's moving on.
Do you really buy the idea that things change dramatically from his camp side at the deadline? Because I don't. Like the idea that, he actually was willing to take less money, but then they asked him to waive his no move clause and that upset him to such a degree that now he's not willing to negotiate. To me, feels like his camp's spin on an ugly situation, trying to justify it more than an actual real reason. I think it was ugly before then.
Yeah. It's been going this way for a long time. So, I mean, the Leafs should have got in their face last summer and said, do you want to extend here? We'd really like you to extend. And if you don't, then we need to move off of you. We can't just let you walk into free agency and let you go. And they had to get more aggressive with it. You know, with the no movement clause, it would have been ugly, but it's better to get ugly a year ago than it being ugly now. And the team takes it on the chin. And so it's a miscalculation by the front office for sure.
Yeah, that's what I mean about being tough in these negotiations and not fearing the idea of players leaving you. Like, it could be tough, but ultimately I'd rather them end up in a situation where they can go, you know what? We didn't overpay. We didn't get gouged by players. We didn't hand out a bunch of no move deals and have an aged roster. Like, yeah, you've got to be able to change your perception around the league. And even with those agents, that you're not just capitulating to whatever demand because you're terrified of losing guys. The last thing I have on Marner, and this is the part that I haven't been able to suss out, and I've heard little things, but they always seem so ridiculous to me. And I've been misunderstood, I think, to a certain standpoint from fans who have listened to this or who have seen me get quote tweeted on stuff. But I don't understand what he's so mad about. Like, I get him being mad at the market and the fans, right? Like, duh. If fans are treating you poorly and you're not having a good time here, I get it. If you don't think that the coverage is fair, fine, whatever. But to not have any relationship with the organization, to have it go so far south that you're not picking up the phone, that you're letting rumors sit out there for weeks on end of what you could be doing in free agency and where you want to go and why you're so upset with the organization that has done so much for you in terms of who you got to play with, how much money you made, the role that you had. Like, I it's lost on me exactly what created such a strong divide between Marner and the Leafs organization.
I just think all the losing has bred this in the organization throughout it. And with the losing comes dysfunction. With the dysfunction comes blaming others and unhappiness. And, you know, I think from Marner's perspective, he just feels like it's time to go do something else. And it's one of the dangers with keeping everyone together for 9 years is that it turns into something ugly. You know, that's my read of, you know, I don't know the specific grievances that would be out there, but I just think this is all born out of the losing, you know, and the losing ends up with finger pointing. And, you know, you see them shouting at each other on the ice and on the bench in those key moments in these big games. And, you know, it gets gift. And you see, you know, some people trying to downplay what it means, but that's when you're really seeing the tension that's there between the top players on the team. And that's very real, you know, and I think that was there all season. And it just, when they can't get it done, it bubbles up. And, you know, you see how like a team like Florida really comes together in the way that they play in the face of, or even Edmonton play in the face of adversity. And you see the closeness there. And I think that all of the losing and the tough moments and the blame game and all that stuff, I think it's driven a wedge between, you know, the Leafs players. And it's created almost the opposite of that. Like, it's not, they can't pull together in those moments, and then they ended up pushing each other apart. And I think Marner's right that it's just time for him to move on. I mean, it's past time. It should have been a year or two ago, and the fact that it didn't happen isn't all on Marner. But I mean, he's going to be hated here for forever, you know, the way that this is going down. But I think a lot of it's on the front office, where they had to have realized that this wasn't working and it was becoming dysfunctional, and it had the chance to blow up in their face, and it did.
It's absolutely on the front office. I put a little less blame on Tree Living, given the situation that he entered with Marner, one where his president had already made up his mind on that player returning after when they had that actual window to trade him. I do think that Tree Living probably should have been harder in trying to pursue a deal or make the negotiations tougher with Marner ahead of the season. And even had they made them public, I think that would have made a difference here. Like, if the guy hates the coverage and hates the blame game and hates the narrative around him, I just think it would have been a tough thing for me to believe that they would have leaked that they asked him to waive his no move and he wasn't willing to do it, but not also sign an extension, that they offered him both those options, that it got out there and became a big point of discussion, and that wouldn't have moved the needle to a certain degree a year ago. And so I do think that was a misplay. But the bigger one was, you're right, year over year over year of not being able to identify the signs and say, God, we have to take a risk here, even if it's something that could end up looking foolish and bite us in the ass, because nothing looks worse than this outcome. I do push back a little bit, though, on the idea that, like, so I think he's going to be hated here by the fans. He'll take a lot of grief on social media. But the way he's got to be looking at it is like, yeah, whatever. I already take a lot of grief on social media. Okay, whatever. I play there a couple times a year and they boo me. I've been booed as a member of the organization when I left the ice. And like, I was at a party that he was at on Saturday. And it's like, these guys are insulated, man. They've got their own crowd. They've got their own people. Like, he's going to be able to be fine living in the city. And you know, like, the odd person might say something to him. But for the most part, it's just going to be your life as usual, just playing in a different place. So I don't think that the detraction from Marner is as big as I think some people think. He'll definitely be hated by fans, no question about it. But I think he's already there. So for him, it's like, oh, what are you really going to fear with this situation?
Yeah, but it didn't have to go this way, though, right? Like, he could have just said last summer, you know what? Like, I don't think this is working. I like to play somewhere else. Like, let's figure something out, and I'll go somewhere else. Like, you know, that would have been the thing to do.
I think that they deluded themselves with the Berube thing a little bit, that was going to be a bigger change. And it was a great change on the ice. Like, the record was good. Like, there were a lot of positives from year one with Berube, but I think that they must have thought that was going to have a bigger impact than it actually ended up having in terms of changing the way that Marner was going to feel about this season. And then again, the idea that they were ever going to get him on a true team friendly number that fans would have looked at and said, yeah, you know what? You had to do that. It's so hard for me to look back on it. And it's not revisionist history, because I said it the entire way through, like, push, push, push. They never pushed. Does it come down to Vegas and LA for you? Or is there someone out there that you think like, no, I could see this?
No, I think that makes sense. And it sounds like it might be a shorter term thing. It could be, you know, 2, 3, or 4 years or something like that. And then he's up again at UFA again at some point.
Okay. So we mentioned how the market is so thin and how they're going to be able to endure a loss of a guy like John Tavares. They apparently really wanted Mason Marchment, and he didn't go for a lot. So before we get into other pivot points, how did they get beat on that deal if they were so high on him?
I think it's a missed opportunity. I think that it's hard to get a 100% answer, but I think that they just didn't have that as like one of their highest priority things that they've been working on to take that opportunity, if that makes sense. So like, I don't know if it's like them saying they really wanted him in hindsight, because it doesn't sound like they were at the front of the line, like banging down the door to get him when he was available. So, but you look at the landscape and you look at the cap space that they've got, and like, that would have made a lot of sense. And I think Mason Marchment would have much rather come here than go to Seattle. So, I mean, and maybe, you know, if Seattle falls out of it, I mean, maybe he's got 1 year left in his deal. He's a UFA. Maybe that's someone that's available via trade in midseason at some point.
Yeah. The only thing is that the price point that he went for to Seattle, it's like, can't you see that just being the price point or even potentially higher come deadline time?
Oh yeah. I'm sure it will be higher. Yeah. Because that's what I mean.
Yeah. It just doesn't make sense to me that they're like, oh, well, maybe he'll be available then. You're like, well, you could have had him the whole time for cheaper. So
I don't know why they didn't do it. To answer your question plainly, I'm not really sure why that didn't happen. And I think it feels like a bit of a mistake on the Leafs' part.
Well, yeah, because it was like, what, a second and a fourth? And
it was a third and a fourth, yeah.
Yeah, or a third and a fourth. Yeah, sorry, it was a third and a fourth. And you go, okay, I get that you guys don't have really any draft capital, that you're really thin here. But yeah, if you're in for a penny, you're kind of in for a pound when it comes to acquiring talent like that in a thin market. And I guess that's the most important. This is sort of the most important question I'm going to ask you in terms of all of this, outside of, I guess, probably the Nyes negotiation, because I do think that one is more important to nail than Tavares. Because even if you let Tavares walk, I'm telling you, I'm okay with it. Like, if I see that number with a different team and it starts with a 7, I'm going, yeah, congrats to him, man. He's earned the right to do it. I'm not going to, well, I was lying and saying I'm not going to fault him, because I think that he should stay here and take a team-friendly number. But yeah, I'll at least be able to understand it. With Nyes, it'll be a little bit more difficult. But the next one is, you know, you look at these off seasons, and I don't think that we frame them properly sometimes with the idea of, okay, yeah, there are options available to you, but what is the actual plan? Like, what are you hoping to achieve? And for me right now, it seems as though they are really hot and heavy for Brad Marchand. Like, that is clearly option number one. That is the most coveted free agent to this team right now, that they're going to make a very strong push for him. They might offer him the 4 years that he really wants, but I'm having difficulty seeing like what the actual number one priorities are for this offseason, and like who the other names are that they're even hoping to be able to add to this roster, or how they're going to be able to do it.
Yeah, no, I think that that's fair. You know, if they miss on Marchand, then they're going to have a whole bunch of cap space. Like, even if they get Tavares and even if they get Nyes Dunn, if they can't get Brad Marchand, they're going to have, I don't know, 12, 14 million. I mean, they've
more
been trying
money
to move
than they need on free agent on the market.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they need players with that money. Like, they need top six forwards with that money, but there's no one for them to sign. So
right.
it's going to be a really tricky situation that they're going to have to manage. And I think that the best course of action is probably just to be patient and wait out the market a little bit. But I don't know if they're going to do that or not, you know, because if you go and you overpay, I mean, pick a name, Tanner Janot or Mangiapane or one of these guys, and you really overpay them and you use up a big chunk of that 12 to 14 million, you're not making your team better, you know? Whereas if you leave some flexibility, like, I think what they might have to do is just take it on the chin in the market. They're going to get criticized, but, you know, leave, maybe sign one guy, but leave some cap space. And then the next time there's a Mason Marchman available, pounce then and make that deal happen. That's probably what they're going to have to do.
Yeah, I got to say with the Mangiapane thing, because that's been out there for a while, it's the same thing with Tavares, where you're going, hey, the only way you're signing that guy early is if he's signing here for a deal that you can't refuse because it's under market value. I just don't look at him as a guy in any place in his career where he'd be doing something like that unless it was like on a 1 or 2 year deal.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll see. But
yeah,
I mean, there's been teams giving players away, like, you know, like, say what you want, but, you know, Hala got, New Jersey just dumped him for nothing. And
yep.
Marchman's the most glaring example, but there's going to be more of that happening because you have this weird situation around the league where there's a whole bunch of teams with tons of cap space. And then there's some contending teams that just have no room at all. And so there's going to be shuffling, and the Leafs have been trying to be active on the trade market. They've been in on a lot of things. And their top priority is trying to find another center, and they've been struggling to do that. But, you know, they're in a lot of discussions. The only question is, like, can they make something happen or not?
Do you think it's more likely they trade a defenseman now?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, just because they don't have a lot to trade.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that they love the idea of trading a defenseman, but if you get into one of those negotiations for one of the top players that's on a trade board around the league, you're going to have to put in a premium asset. And like, what premium assets do the Leafs have to put on the table in that situation? And, you know, one of the only ones I can think of is Brandon Carlo. And it seems weird to think about moving him, given you just got him and,
yeah,
you know, he made Riley better and he's a right shot defenseman and he's 6'6" and all of these things, but he's one of the few things. He doesn't have trade protection.
Yeah.
And he's a valuable asset at 3.4 million. So you can probably get a really good player for him. And I wonder if maybe they do that.
Well, it's funny because when we're talking about trading defensemen, obviously they're not trading Tanev. I think that's pretty clear. I don't know what the value of Simon Benoit would be, that it's more valuable than what he is for your team. People will point to Ekman Larson and go, well, what about him? And I'm like, I just don't know if he returns you a lot in a deal. Given his age, given the miles on the tires, it just, yeah, I maybe I'm wrong, but I've never viewed Ekman Larson as like a blue chip trade. It really does feel like, yeah, Riley, obviously with his no move clause and the fact that it doesn't seem like that he wants to waive it, and the organization still not learning from the Marner mistake and saying, well, maybe we should just be harder on the guys going, yeah, all right, we're seeing the Marner thing play out, but we're going to do the same with Riley. But yeah, Carlo does feel like weirdly the number one trade piece that this organization has.
Yeah, and it's going to create a hole, right? Like, you know, and then probably during the season, you're going to say, we got to find a right shot defenseman. And
of course,
there's a lot of teams looking for centers right now, but there's also a lot of teams that really want a right shot top four defenseman. So the Leafs actually have something that they potentially could move. And, you know, you'll have to get by with playing Philippe Myers with Riley again, or moving Ekman Larson to the right side and just trying to get by.
Signing somebody. Yeah, but, you could also sign. You could do the little flip and then sign someone else. But the point is,
there's no right shot defenseman to sign. Yeah. though. You know. So,
I just mean I think probably something that you could do better than Philip Myers.
Yeah. So you know, I could see it happening. You know, and that's the kind of creative thinking that I think the front office has to engage in, because otherwise, it's just going to be spending too much money on guys that aren't worth it in free agency.
I was really hoping that it was going to be drama free with their free agents. I was really hoping that they were going to already have a little bit of business done. And yet here we are again, having a lot of the same conversations about agents and market values and I hate it. James Myrtle of The Athletic, thanks for doing this. We'll maybe talk to you later this week if something big happens.
Okay. Sounds good.
See you, buddy. James Riddle of The Athletic. Subscribe to this podcast. Reach out anytime on Twitter and Instagram at JD Bunkus. I like hearing from people. I got to tell you though, like I really do feel as though this should be the consensus. The idea that you can pay Tavares even close to market value is nuts to me. If he was even 33, you could talk me into it a little bit more, but it's just, I don't even know what I'm buying in the next couple of years. And so to be doing that at anything other than a huge discount, to not think that any of this has mattered to him, living here, playing here, being a Maple Leaf, you got to be able to play this one tough. The Nyes situation is a little bit more different because of that offer sheet. And God, if you lost Matthew Nyes, like, oof. Or if you ended up even just having to match an offer sheet that was more than you had originally agreed to or were in the ballpark of, that would suck too. But at some point, you have to take more hardline stances in a league that is getting harder and harder to win in, with other teams around the league squeezing their players successfully. You got to be there. You have to be there. Toronto has to be a market where you go, no, it's a desirable one, not a, oh, it's because you get overpaid there. Anyway, quick break, and I want to talk about the Kevin Durant trade. Houston Rockets and the Phoenix Suns consummated a trade for Kevin Durant earlier in the day. And I saw a lot of people hand-wringing about the return and really killing the Suns for this deal. And I got to tell you, I don't think it's a good deal for the Suns. Like, obviously, what they did with Mikal Bridges and four first-round picks, Cam Johnson, they turning that into what they have now is a disaster. But this is what I was saying all along with Kevin Durant. He's 37 years old. What were you buying? To get the 10 pick and to get Jalen Green and Dylan Brooks, who's at least a good rotation player, like, that's appropriate market value. 5 seconds, whatever. Blake Murphy loves those. But that was why I was always very confused by the Raptors' involvement and this talk about Poeltl and all. It's like, no. It wasn't the situation. So I actually think that the Suns did okay, all things considered. But that the market was right for once on one of these deals. We'll be back tomorrow. We'll see you then.